A new report outlines the primary sources of carbon pollution in Montana and the U.S. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce previews projects in the works for the National Day of Service. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry profiles Glacier Park's new superintendent. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with education researcher Brandon Bastide about why so many college graduates are not finding the jobs of their dreams. A new report says a handful of coal-burning power plants in Montana are responsible for over half the state's carbon pollution. The Environment Montana Research and Policy Center report ranks what it says are Montana's five most polluting power plants. According to this report, they are Colstrip and J.E. Corette, the Hardin Generating Station, Yellowstone Energy Limited Partnership, and the Lewis and Clark Station. The report says Colstrip, east of Billings, is the 18th most carbon-polluting plant in the nation. The America's Dirtiest Power Plants report comes as the Environmental Protection Agency prepares to release proposed rules for reducing emissions from new power plants. The Montana Environmental Information Center's Ann Hedges says pollution's a difficult problem to address, but adds in Montana there are, as she puts it, some low-hanging fruit out there.
And in Montana, that low-hanging fruit just happens to be coal plants. This report is really good at underscoring the fact that coal plants in Montana are where we're going to get our most bang for the buck when we try to solve this climate crisis. In 2011, burning fossil fuels for electricity generation produced about 41% of the total U.S. carbon emissions. Coal plants alone were responsible for 80% of the global warming pollution from the electric power plants, even though they only produce 42% of the nation's electricity. So they are an overwhelming contributor to climate change in comparison to other forms of electricity generation.
Hedges says there's little merit to the argument that coal is a reliable and cheap energy source. She says since 2009, Colstrip Unit 4 has been out of service twice for at least 6 months at a time.
That's time when the wind's still blowing and the sun is still shining, but the coal plant isn't operating, or at least that unit of the coal plant is not operating. We know that the U.S. coal fleet, the average capacity factor, is 64%. That's not a great capacity factor. That means it's not available all the time. We know that coal is not cheap. We know that the Montana Public Service Commission has said that Colstrip is the most expensive or the second most expensive energy or electricity resource that Northwestern Energy gets. That is passed on to ratepayers. Ratepayers are paying more money for Colstrip, and Colstrip is not reliable. And now this report underscores the fact that it's also one of the biggest polluters in the nation.
Hedges says it's time to talk about making the transition to renewable energy resources, such as wind power.
Wind is incredibly reliable in Montana. Montana has the second best wind resource in the United States. So the wind blows here in certain areas a lot, which is what makes wind energy so inexpensive in Montana. We are a transmission-constrained state. That is absolutely true. Right now, most of Colstrip power goes out of state. It goes to Washington and Oregon and Idaho. If we start reducing the energy that is produced by Colstrip, we can replace the power on that existing line with cleaner power, and we don't have to build any more lines.
A report released earlier this summer by the Natural Resources Defense Council showed cutting carbon pollution could create up to 3,600 jobs in Montana and reduce average monthly utility bills by $1.25. Environment Montana's Travis Madsen says energy efficiency practices will play an important role in this new clean energy model.
There's a lot of opportunity to reduce the amount of electricity that we're using and still get the same level of services that we expect just by reducing waste. And the more of that we can capture, the easier it will be to clean up these dirty power plants and make sure that our economy still works.
The EPA is expected to unveil its proposed pollution rules for new power plants on September 20th.
And in other news from around the state, a northwestern Montana woman who had been the subject of a missing and endangered persons alert has been found in Portland, Oregon, along with a man suspected of committing a violent crime against her. Police in Troy issued the alert for 36-year-old Sandra LaFoon last Friday. In late August, LaFoon reported that 36-year-old Dan Savage Jr. had committed a violent act against her. He fled the scene and a warrant was issued for his arrest. Both were reported missing on September 2nd. Police say LaFoon and Savage were located in Portland, Oregon yesterday. LaFoon was found safe and Savage was arrested.
U.S. Senator Max Baucus says the situation with Syria is too fluid to say how he might vote on a resolution. Baucus told the Associated Press today that the situation has changed, with recent developments suggesting the possibility of a diplomatic end to Syria's use of chemical weapons banned by international treaty. The Obama administration has lobbied for a congressional vote this week calling for military action against Syria, a request that has so far received a lukewarm response. Baucus said developments may change what Congress is asked to vote on. Democratic U.S. Senator John Tester has not said how he might vote. Republican U.S. Representative Steve Daines said after an hour-long telephone town hall yesterday that he will oppose military action in Syria.
Governor Steve Bullock is wrapping up a two-week back-to-school tour. Bullock used the tour to examine education at all levels and all across the state, from cities to towns and Indian reservations. The governor called a meeting of his full cabinet to discuss findings from the tour. He says coordination from the different state agencies around education is critical.
Even at our level at times, what we might start thinking as well, this is just either the role of a local school board, or the OPI, or the Commission of Higher Education. But part of the message that we're trying to give is that we all really have a stake in ensuring that our students and our kids are getting a quality education.
Bullock's education policy advisor, Shannon O'Brien, spoke to the cabinet about the administration's priorities. The tour visited sites providing early childhood education, an issue O'Brien says has everything to do with return on investment.
And you've heard the governor say before that a dollar here can equal $7 in the future. And depending on how you slice it, it can really equal more than that.
The governor also wants to focus on reducing the high school dropout rate, putting in place effective educational standards for students, and promoting the use of dual enrollment. Dual enrollment courses allow high school students to earn college credit as well. O'Brien says the state is seeing a significant rise in dual enrollment opportunities in schools.
It was fun to hear the testimony of some of these students talk about the meaningful relationships they had with these college professors and that intimidation was minimized after they had had this class and the concept of going into college wasn't out of reach for them.
Governor Bullock visited a total of 17 schools during his back-to-school tour.
The anniversary of September 11th tomorrow also marks the National Day of Service. The event was founded as a way to reclaim the sense of unity felt around the country in the wake of 9/11, to reclaim that sense through joining together in service projects to meet local needs. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us more about some efforts to watch.
About 15 cardboard boxes are sitting throughout the buildings occupied by the State Department of Public Health and Human Services. Signs on the boxes ask for donations for the Great Rollout.
The Great Rollout. It originally started, it was a rollout of just toilet paper.
A drive for toilet paper. AmeriCorps Vista volunteer Jesse Shiva says it has been expanded to a drive for toiletries in general. The boxes have been hanging around the buildings for more than a week, and people have been giving.
Toothpaste, towelettes, tissues, floss.
Giving even beyond the toiletry theme.
We do have a can of Campbell's soup here.
We do. If you decide to donate food, that's also accepted.
But why toiletries? Well, everything gathered goes to veterans. Vets going through hard times, maybe staying at the local homeless shelter. Shiva says the toiletry drive is a showing of respect toward these people. People for whom toothpaste and shampoo may be luxury items.
A lot of veterans here in Helena are looking for jobs, are eager to find work, and, you know, the basics are needed to help them in their everyday life.
On September 11th, 10 or so AmeriCorps volunteers will be posted at a couple of grocery stores in the capital city, providing lists of the items the drive is looking for, asking for support. Service efforts are happening all over Montana for the event. Jackie Girard is the state director for the Corporation for National and Community Service. That's the umbrella organization that facilitates volunteer programs like AmeriCorps and Senior Corps. Those groups are hosting a lunch in Livingston to honor veterans, law enforcement, and other public servants. Bozeman is hosting a blanket drive. Girard says some eastern Montana communities are holding an event called Harvest for Seniors.
And that's where they're collecting extra garden produce to be donated for seniors in need.
The state is hoping more than just those involved in AmeriCorps or Senior Corps set aside some time on Wednesday to engage in some kind of community service. Lieutenant Governor John Walsh says the events of September 11th, 2001 stand as this generation's Pearl Harbor. And in remembering 9/11, he says it's a perfect time to show support for fellow Montanans.
If you look around our state, there's a tremendous amount of volunteerism and support, but we are just asking, you know, for people to really focus on that on September 11th.
Corporation for National and Community Service State Director Jackie Girard says the event really looks to honor and remember everyone who supported the events of 9/11, EMTs, firefighters, police officers.
Most people say that they would have volunteered if they were only asked. So this is a way to provide opportunities for people on 9/11 and around 9/11.
And she hopes some who do decide to volunteer on Wednesday continue to make service a bigger part of their lives. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Several grocery stores in Missoula will also be hosting a toiletry drive tomorrow to benefit the Missoula YWCA. You can find details on all the National Day of Service events hosted by AmeriCorps and Senior Corps on our website. Visit this story on mtpr.org.
Glacier National Park's new leader says the park is facing many challenges and opportunities. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry talks with Superintendent Jeff Mao about budgets, community, and climate change.
New superintendent of Glacier Park, Jeff Mao, has been to the park before. He worked as a geologic field assistant with the U.S. Geological Survey in southwestern Montana in college and worked on the western edge of Glacier Park during the Red Bench Fire of 1988 that scorched the ground around Polebridge. At the time, he was a new ranger at Glacier Bay National Park in Alaska.
It was really quite exciting in many respects, but also you understood the magnitude of what the event because, you know, coastal Alaska being asked to come down and fight fire in Montana was pretty extraordinary.
Mao is heading south to Glacier National Park after more than 20 years working in Alaska.
I have actually had the northernmost duty station in the National Park Service, which is in the small Eskimo village of Anaktuvik Pass in the Brooks Range. I lived there for a couple years. So anything is moving south in the National Park Service.
Mao has also worked as a park ranger at Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park and district ranger, chief of operations, and subsistence manager at Gates of the Arctic National Park. He's served as a congressional fellow working with the U.S. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee and as superintendent at Kenai Fjords. He says he was once given a piece of advice. As a representative of the Park Service, he had the choice of being on the local volunteer ambulance or fire department.
What I really took away from that was just how important it was for the National Park Service to be not just near a community, but to be part of the community.
Mao identifies challenges facing Glacier, including an aging infrastructure in the park buildings, as well as budget uncertainties.
We are quickly approaching the beginning of the fiscal year, and, you know, it's still very uncertain how Congress will handle the new fiscal year, whether it'll be through a continuing resolution, continuous sequestration, you know, higher levels of sequestration. We just don't know.
Mao says this is a challenge to maintain flexibility through the year to manage for shifting budget numbers. He sees opportunities for the park with the National Park Service Centennial in 2016. Also, Mao says the ongoing corridor management plan is the next step with construction on the Going to the Sun Road slated to wrap up in the next couple of years. Another issue bringing uncertainty is climate change.
How we respond to climate change and you know, understanding how the natural ecosystem is responding to climate change. Looking at, you know, how we as the agency managing this landscape should be responding to climate change. Those are all things that I've been a part of.
Mao was in Glacier in 2010 as part of the Crown Managers Partnership.
But we were looking at, you know, what's possible, plausible in terms of climate in the future. And you know, sort of expanding the understanding of, you know, that we cannot depend on what we understand historically has happened here.
Mao calls managing in the face of a changing climate a difficult and interesting balance.
What's important about the national parks is not only for us to have intact ecosystems, but for us to have outstanding recreational opportunities and for people to learn and understand about how sensitive some of these ecosystems are.
Mao says another area he intends to focus energy on is growing partnerships with community organizations, as well as connecting young people with the park. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
As we reported last night, many college graduates have jobs that have nothing to do with their degree, and many are not happy with the jobs they do have. These are just some of the findings of a recent survey done by Gallup Education, a research arm of the Gallup Polling Service. Brandon Busteed is the executive director of Gallup Education. In this feature interview, he talks with news director Sally Mock about the need for helping students find what they're best at.
So most people know us for our polling work, which we've been doing for 70-plus years. And our polling, actually, interestingly enough, is one of the smallest pieces of the work we do at Gallup, and are involved in some major things like our World Poll, where we're statistically sampling 98% of the world's population every year, measuring things like well-being and other important elements of their lives. And part of what we do in our education division is research that is pretty powerful within schools, so measuring student engagement, teacher engagement, and also doing things like assessments of teaching talent. Those are examples of some of the things we do in the education world.
What do you mean by engagement?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So everybody throws that term around pretty loosely, right? A lot of people have different definitions of engagement. Gallup's is pretty particular in that we got interested in engagement and the measure of it. So we would describe it as kind of emotional engagement, right, in what you're doing in your work, in school, et cetera. And we have done research for decades now that quantify that. So the reason why we got interested is that we found that the ways we were measuring engagement were predictors of key performance indicators like revenue, profit, absenteeism, turnover, right? All these things that businesses and organizations look at as their ultimate outcome. It turns out that employee engagement and customer engagement are leading indicators of how well an organization is doing. So some of our measures of engagement include things like saying that you like what you do each day, saying that at work you have the chance to do what you're best at every day, that you have a supervisor who cares about your development, that in the last week you've received recognition for work that you've done. One of the funny ones is I have a best friend at work. And these items actually translate pretty readily into school. So if you say I have a best friend at school, that's a pretty clear predictor of engagement, which is also linked to better grades, more likely to complete, all those kinds of things. So our measures of engagement are very particular in that they are have been found in research to be predictors of key performance indicators, and that's why we're really interested in them.
And what you have found, and this is intriguing, is that college graduates are not as engaged in their work as those who don't have a college degree, which I think would surprise many, many people.
It shocked everybody, right? Because on the surface, we would just assume that if you get a college degree, that you're more engaged in your work, right? I mean, that's an assumption that I think most people would make. And in reality, Gallup just announced this finding about 2 months ago. So we're still puzzling on it in interesting ways, too. But we found that by educational attainment, those with a college degree are the least engaged in their work of anybody. If you get a postgraduate degree, engagement bumps up a little bit over just having a college degree. But compared to Americans that have just a high school degree, college graduates are less engaged. Now, this is true across all age demographics, across all income level, and it's also true across all job types. So, for example, even managers, which is a disproportionately college degreed kind of role. If you're a manager with a college degree, you are less engaged statistically than a manager who just has a high school degree. So it was a pretty crazy finding.
And you've written about this in a blog that, quote, something about college isn't working. It appears it doesn't do a good enough job of bringing students closer to figuring out what they're best at.
Yep. So when we dug into the data, it was interesting because the study was done by our workplace engagement team, not our education team. And when they first found this finding about college grads being less engaged, they theorized that it was probably because college grads have higher expectations of the workplace, right? You get a college degree, and so you expect more out of work, and then it's not met. And that was a really solid theory. What confused us was that if you got a postgraduate degree, engagement went back up. And you would think that if it's about, you know, high maintenance and expectations, that if you get more college and a more advanced degree, you would have even higher expectations of the workplace. And so we were confused. So we dug into it, and at an item level, the item – so there were about 12 items that we used to measure engagement. As an index, obviously that was important, but we were interested in the item level. And the item that differentiated college grads from everybody else was – at work, I have the chance to do what I do best every day. College graduates, much less likely to say that. And there's really two things that I wrote about that we think are driving this, but it'd be interesting to hear what people think as well. One is that we know, this is a fact, that 50% of recent college graduates, so 0 to 10 years out, and this is probably true for those more than 10 years out, are in jobs that don't require a college degree. So we have an awful lot of Americans who got a college degree and are now in a job that doesn't require a degree. And so when you're
overqualified,
So when they're asked a question about whether they do what they're best at every day, they probably interpret that as, well, I got a law degree and I'm not a lawyer. No, I'm not doing what I'm best at every day, right? And then the other thing that we thought about, which is very interesting, was what we called the achiever path. The idea that a lot of people are very successful, they do everything they're told, they get good grades all the way through college, right? They achieve on everybody else's definition of success in life at the cost of figuring out what was right for them, right? So this is the person that graduates from Harvard and gets a great job and then wakes up one day and hates what they're doing and realizes they're not doing what they're best at, and you know, all of a sudden they have this crisis moment, and they did everything everybody told them, but they didn't land in the place that made them successful.
Mm-hmm. So how do we fix that, Mr. Yeah. Bestie? That would be the more important question, yes?
It is. It's the so one is just to ask the question, are there things we can do to change that outcome, right? We know the outcome is real, right? So this is not an indictment of a type of college, right? Because we looked at all college graduates. So this is a representative sample of college graduates in the U.S. And so this is not just about private liberal arts. This is not about public. This is not about tier. This is a statement about college degrees, right? So I think we have to think about what are the things systemically that are true about all college, right? And so that's why we've landed on these two things. One, there is a misalignment very clearly in this country between the degrees conferred by colleges and universities and the jobs available. So on one hand, we need to do a far better job collaborating at a state level, a local level, a national level between institutions of higher education and the people who are employers in those areas, whether they're businesses, nonprofit, government agencies, right, to have a much clearer understanding of the jobs that are needed, right, the skill set that's needed, and make sure we do a better job of aligning what degrees we're conferring with jobs available, right? And that's not easy to do, but I think we can do a much better job. Not a lot of conversations taking place between large employers and local universities and that level. And then the other one is to just think about the experience of college. To what degree are we allowing individuals, or what degree are we helping them figure out what they like to do and what they're best at? And that's pretty fundamental, right? That can happen across all different subjects, different institutions, but something about the college experience right now, we're not allowing for enough of that to take place. If we were, we would see much better outcomes with college graduates landing in a place where they say they do what they're best at. They love what they do each day, right? I mean, things that we know are critical to how people evaluate their lives, for example.
Most colleges do try, don't they, to meet that, though? I mean, they start out with a sort of a general education requirements. They hope that the incoming students will experiment with different subjects till they find something that piques their interest and that might be a lifelong career for them.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a real important and critical distinction around exploring, which I would encourage people to do, right? The idea of, you know, being able to test a few things, right? Test a few different kinds of roles or jobs or whatever. I would actually argue that we're doing a poor job of that from an experiential perspective, right? So I think from an academic perspective, a content perspective, we are allowing students to explore a lot. But to actually be able to explore different role types and different jobs, this is about more internships, more mentorships. I think it's actually for externships for teachers and faculty, right? How many faculty and teachers have recently had an experience working in a workplace, right? Or have they ever outside of academia, right? So to understand what's happening in the modern workplace, to have those experiences. So I think we can do a lot more in the experiential side of things. I think you're right. From a curriculum standpoint, we are doing broad exposure, especially in a liberal arts degree, for example. But, you know, I think that that's where we're falling down, is on the actual experiences that give people a real taste for that. And then the difference between testing a bunch of things and actually finding one or two that you get deeply engaged in to a degree where you really understand what it is or isn't, right? So if I'm just, you know, sampling the flavor of the day all the time and never really consistently eating chocolate to realize, do I like chocolate over 5 years of time or do I just like the first taste of chocolate? I think that's a pretty important one too. What we see is a lot of people advocating kids, young people, to get involved in a whole bunch of things at the cost of getting involved in any one or two of them in a very meaningful way. So who cares if you have 17 extracurricular activities listed on your resume if you didn't actually deeply engage in any one of those, right? So that's something I think we should all challenge as we think about what we're espousing.
It's fascinating data and fascinating to think about because certainly education is in a real navel-gazing period right now, so this contributes to that for sure. I've been speaking with Brandon Busteed, who's the executive director of Gallup Education. And Mr. Busteed, thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for allowing me to be with you today.
In tonight's weather forecast, across all three of our listening areas, tonight expect clear skies with lows in the 40s. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies with highs in the 90s. And now for the editorial comments of Dan Gallagher.
This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint. Let's begin with this premise. The reason that veterans were initially called to military service was to defend our nation's liberties from an enemy or enemies whose goal was to destroy those freedoms and to defend, sustain, or advance our nation's principles and interests. Now, I'm not claiming that veteran status qualifies us as foreign affairs experts, nor can it be used as evidence that our knowledge of military matters surpasses our non-veteran peers. But I do think that our willingness to serve has earned us a hearing, and that the experience that turned us into veterans gives us an insight about war, what leads to it, what it's like to fight a war, and what its residual effects might be. Therefore, as a war veteran, I offer this opinion about our pending use of force in Syria. Don't do it, Mr. President. Our proposed action there is impractical in so many ways and opens the door to escalation of an already too horrible and too ominous situation, not only in Syria, but throughout the Middle East. From the standpoint of practicality, how do the planners of airstrikes to deter gas attacks propose to pull it off? Are we going to attack the depots where the sarin gas is stored? Dumb idea. That simply releases it into the ether to kill anyone downwind. Do we attack the plants that make the gas? Do we really think that we could destroy them with any thoroughness without inflicting countless collateral damage, that is, the deaths of non-combatants? Now, surely Assad has prepared for possible attacks by hiding and moving the stored gas and the factories that make it, and has likely blended those sites in with the civilian population so that even the most surgical airstrike would bring civilian death and destruction. Are we going to attack Syria's political or military leadership? Do we really believe that that will end the problem, that there will not be others ready to assume command with just as evil a policy as those before? And if those who use the gas believe their end is nearing, do we not understand that they'd not hesitate to use it again, to go out in a blaze of glory, so to speak? And from the purview of world politics, diplomacy, and our own long-term interests, while recognizing that Assad is a murderous thug, an SOB, do we really believe that the rebels, whom we might be helping, are any more our friends than he? Dream on. Didn't we learn from a debacle in Iraq that our efforts to government build simply destabilize the region where we seek stability? And frankly, is that our right or our role? As a veteran of the Vietnam War, I've reached the obvious conclusion that while we can and should help in a humanitarian way, the United States cannot intervene in a civil war without worsening the situation, and we cannot throw our military weight around in a culture in which we're already suspect without doing untold damage to our already precarious position there. In short, America cannot play Lone Ranger to the world. Now, tomorrow we'll remember the events of 9/11 from 12 years ago, and in a commentary on September 25th, 2001, I talked of the dangers that could result from overreaction, and I warned of the dangers of war fever and bubble patriotism, and how our going to war in the Middle East would destabilize that whole region. And that's just what has happened in the past 10 years. Are we now on the edge of doing it again? Finally, and of greatest importance to veterans who themselves have known war up close, is this reality. War, despite Clausewitz's observation, cannot be merely an extension of politics by other means. Listen to these words. I know war as few other men now living know it, and nothing to me is more revolting. I've long advocated its complete abolition, as its very destructiveness on both friend and foe has rendered it useless as a means of settling international disputes. Now, those are not the words of some pacifist or of a Mahatma Gandhi or even of Czechoslovakia's embattled World War II leader, Jan Masaryk. No, those were the words of General Douglas MacArthur, and he certainly was no peace freak. War is not the answer. Attacking Syria is not the answer. True, Assad and his ilk are despicable and deserve the worst, but we can't bring peace and stability with airstrikes and cruise missiles. Now, I realize that I could be wrong, that there may be things about this that I don't know or comprehend, but there must be a better way. And then today, I heard talk about UN supervision in Syria, and that, in spite of UN flaws, is at least worth consideration. The president will talk to us tonight, and I hope he offers us possibilities that make military action unnecessary. Veterans are not strangers to war, and they certainly do not lack the courage or willpower to carry on the struggle to protect our freedom and our interests. But veterans, perhaps more than any others, know the price of war, of military action, and of its limitations. So, as a veteran, I repeat, hold off on the airstrikes, Mr. President. This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint.
Dan Gallagher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. Montana Evening Edition is archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.